Welcome to the Archives of the Loralee Show, conversation for exploration, timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuyamangue Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuyamangueInstitute.com and Loralee.com. Welcome to Conversation for Exploration. Hi, I'm your host, Loralee. When those who have a near-death experience come back and are convinced that they went to another realm, and yet scientists say, well, it was only a biochemical reaction that gave you this illusion, who's right? And whatever happened to those fascinating LSD experiments that were really taking some inroads into psychotherapy? Why are we so freaked out about hallucinatory experiences, and yet indigenous cultures the world over throughout time has made that a key component of their culture, the ability to transcend dimensions? Well, Rick Strassman has some answers to those questions. He's currently a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the University of New Mexico School of Medicine. He's also the author of DMT, The Spirit Molecule. He conducted a series of tests with DMT. It's put out by the adrenal glands. The pituitary glands. It's a natural component of our body. He was able to experiment with some volunteers and find out just how profound a molecule this is and how profound effect it has on our mystical experiences. Rick joins us from Taos, New Mexico. Hi, Rick. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me, Laura.
Well, tell me a bit of background about yourself first and how you started to look into these intriguing matters.
Well, I first got interested in just the possibility of psychedelic research during my undergraduate days, which was I went to Stanford as an undergraduate. This was in the early 1970s. And there was just getting to be an interest in altered states of consciousness, such as dreams, meditation. And it was also just at the cusp of the end of the first wave of human psychedelic research that had essentially started with the discovery of LSD around the end of World War II.
Did you yourself participate in those kinds of recreational activities at the time?
I had a lot of friends that were experimenting with those drugs, and I would hang out with them, pretty regularly. And I was amazed at a couple things. I was amazed at the profundity of the actual experiences that were being had, and I was also struck as I was doing more study with the similarities between the states people were having with psychedelics, especially with LSD, and the descriptions of reports from the ancient mystical literature of deep meditation. Also, at the time, there were just the beginnings of reports about the frequency and phenomenology of near-death experiences.
You decided to go looking for the neurochemical basis for such things.
Well, I figured if all these people were having these kinds of experiences, either with or without drugs, yes, there must be some biological commonality. So I began wondering if the brain itself made a psychedelic drug, and if so, where that might actually take place. And I was led to the possibility of the pineal gland, which had been sort of impugned as a mystical gland or a mystical organ in the center of the brain as a potential location of the production of a psychedelic compound.
So give us a quick history, though, of the use of psychedelics in general. They go back long, long ways in human history, don't they?
Well, sure. People have always been interested in altering their consciousness through, I guess, what you'd call external means, by drinking or smoking or snuffing barks and roots and leaves
mushrooms.
And those sorts of things. you know, people have been drinking wine for tens of thousands of years. And there's a couple of hypotheses out that ancient man would observe animals eating certain mushrooms or certain leaves of plants and appear to be intoxicated. And it was through mimicking the consumption of these substances that they observed in other animals that humans discovered or kind of stumbled upon the mind-altering properties of certain plants.
I've also heard that animals will eat fermented berries, in effect, ingesting alcohol voluntarily, that they'll actually seek these kinds of fruit trees that have rotted and berry bushes and all of that out, from everything from birds to elephants. Is it true?
Well, it seems to be the case, yes. There does seem to be almost an innate instinct to alter one's consciousness that probably extends far beyond just the human in terms of its applicability to other animal species. You know, it could be even considered on par with the urge to procreate, to sleep, to eat, those sorts of things. Almost an instinctual
urge. Oh, Von Siegel
urge.
Says that it's a sixth drive to alter our state of consciousness.
That could be the case. We certainly spend a lot of time in dream sleep every night. So it certainly seems like there's some almost biological requirement for an altered state of consciousness. There's certainly a lot of plants and mushrooms that contain quite powerful mind-altering chemicals.
Isn't it interesting that the plants that grow here on Earth would grow in such a way that the ingestion of them would simulate compounds that we readily produce or that we have the receptor sites for? It's when you look at evolution and the, you know, the pollination sequence, well, flowers will look like certain female bees to a certain brand of bee and
right.
This and the other. They're always trying to induce some interaction. So it's really not surprising that these plants would interact with humans and other mammals and our brains in such a way, I guess.
Well, I think so. And I think once people found out about how amazing the states of mind were that the ingestion of certain plants could result in, then those plants became holy or became extremely valuable to humans, and they would be protected and cultivated. So there is certainly an evolutionary advantage to plants having these profound states on consciousness.
Oh, okay. So where did you take your research from there? You knew that there was this historical basis, a lot of intriguing mystical experiences that people are reporting, ancient literature as well as in the present.
Yeah, so I started to investigate whether the pineal gland might be a possible location for the production of a brain chemical that simulated or underlie or kind of mimicked or induced a profoundly psychedelic state of consciousness. Actually, to backtrack a bit, the whole issue of plants and animals, their sort of symbiotic relationship with these chemicals, once it became time for me to decide what particular compound to study, I chose to study DMT, which is actually abbreviation for dimethyltryptamine. And it's a chemical in plants and in animals as well. It's a naturally made compound that occurs in a huge number of plants. It's actually getting to be more interesting to comment or to describe plants that don't make DMT as those in which it actually is found. It's so profusely distributed among the plant kingdom.
And so we're ingesting this DMT a lot naturally anyway.
Well,
and our pituitary gland is producing it. So, but it must be in very small amounts.
In small amounts, and it's also being made in our liver and in other parts of our brain. Also, it's made in the blood through the mechanism of red blood cells. They make DMT as well. So there are a number of organs in the animal body which produce measurable amounts of DMT constantly. And it's also found in plants. So it seems to be this kind of common denominator among the hallucinogens, kind of crossing both the plant and
when you
animals.
Think, though, Rick, that every night we have, what, how many sleep cycles, and part of those sleep cycles include dreaming, and dreaming is a visionary state.
For sure.
So maybe we just need a ready supply of this to go dreaming every night.
Well, I think that's a very strong possibility, that the production of dreams is mediated through elevated levels of DMT. You know, the whole question of whether or not the pineal gland makes DMT is still, it's still not really been definitively determined. But even if the pineal gland weren't the only location for the production of DMT, there's plenty of other organs in the body which have been quite well documented to produce it.
Then there must be something to do with the pineal gland about putting out another enzyme or hormone that regulates its use, because it's, you know, it's timed. You know, we must use it in the body during those sleep cycles and during mystical moments, and you say during other accidental releases.
Well, for sure. Yeah, well, I think there's probably a role for chronically small levels of DMT circulating in our brains at all times. One of the most interesting elements of DMT is that it's actively transported into the brain across a gradient, which is the case only with a very few precious food sources and other things that the brain requires for normal function.
So it's hardwired to use it.
It seems hardwired both to use it and to kind of seek it out, as if a certain amount of DMT is required for normal brain function. And if you blockade the effects of DMT with, let's say, antipsychotic medications, like, for example, if you give a normal volunteer an antipsychotic medication which blocks DMT, it seems to sort of flatten out the perception of the world. Things become rather gray and dull and lifeless. So it might be the case that people require a certain amount of DMT just as a maintenance sort of way of keeping our perceptual apparatus as sharp and bright as it normally is.
When you think about it, though, I mean, what is our a perceptual apparatus doing but creating an illusion that has its cues in the natural world and the vibrations around us? But
well, I think so. It's a bit of a startling idea when you think about it. You know, if you, you know, it's almost as if this compound is a thermostat for our version of reality. And if it gets up, you know, if levels become too high, let's say for any number of the scenarios that I describe in the book, or else if you ingest large amounts of DMT, then clearly you break through the threshold to a whole, an entirely different realm of consciousness and existence.
And then your seeing apparatus is able to go along with you in order to perceive it. So, wow. How fascinating. So how long have you been actively involved with dimethyltryptamine, DMT?
Well, I began all of the required paperwork to get the study going in 1988. It was going to be the first new human psychedelic research in a generation. Human studies first really began, like I was mentioning before, with the discovery of LSD around 1942, 44 or so.
Maybe we should take a moment to get a quick history of the study of psychedelics, because yours is really the latest chapter in a long story.
Pretty much. Well, it's not that long a story when you look at the whole historical perspective of these plants, but in terms of modern Western science, it's not been that long that people have actually systematically investigated the effects and biology of these drugs.
Where did we begin? Where did hallucinogens first come on the scene? It was LSD,
well,
wasn't it?
Pardon?
You're the expert on this. You tell me the story.
The first kind of studies in, I guess, what you'd call contemporary scientific investigation occurred around the turn of Well, around the late 1890s, early 1900s, with the discovery of mescaline in peyote cactus. And the Germans performed some studies early on. There are a few American studies, but for any number of reasons, people really were not that interested in the effects of mescaline. It was kind of well.
You point out that people were vomiting and it's nauseous, so it's not a very pleasant compound to take.
Well, yeah, it caused an enormous number of physical side effects, and also I think an issue is just the scientific culture wasn't really prepared to understand what it was doing to the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So there were maybe 10, 15 studies of mescaline around the turn of last century, but it wasn't until the discovery of LSD, which actually took place at around the same time as the discovery of serotonin. And once people were able to actually investigate the interaction of serotonin in the brain with the effects of LSD in the brain, that there actually could be a way of understanding how these drugs produce their psychological effects.
Tell us about serotonin.
Well, serotonin was first discovered in blood vessels, actually, and then it was discovered in the gut, the intestines, the stomach, and the like. And then it was discovered in the brain. It was the first of, obviously, many neurotransmitters, which were discovered that were involved in communication among and between neurons in the brain. And its discovery, as well as the discovery of LSD and the anti-LSD or antipsychotic effects of drugs like Thorazine, all took place at around the same time, in the late 1940s or so. And so the discovery of those three compounds at around the same time kind of ushered in what I guess is known as the modern era of psychopharmacology, the effects of drugs on the brain and consciousness.
You know, I've heard from those who've gone down to indigenous cultures and studied with shamans, that bioprospectors and the such, that they don't observe any mental illness in indigenous cultures. The shamans take care of it. It just doesn't arise.
Uh-huh.
But look at this culture and look at all the, you know, the crazy people and the disturbed people. And so I can understand early on if you look at, well, here's something that activates hallucinations and here's something over here, Thorazine, that quiets it down.
Right.
And we see crazy people not being able to control these hallucinatory, you know, what's going, I can understand where they got freaked out about, well, if it's a hallucinant, it's bad. Whereas the indigenous people had very controlled ways, safe ways, I guess. Who knows? Maybe we didn't hear about the disaster stories of using these substances and for a spiritual purpose. So is there a true comparison in all the investigation you've done between what's happening in a crazy person, what I don't know what the technical term you would want to use, and the safe and mediated use of hallucinogens in a culture that uses them in a sacred way?
Well, that's a big question.
We can tackle that on down the road as we put those pieces together.
Yeah.
But I mean, you can see early on where, you know, gee.
Well, I think one thing that may occur in not quite as technologically advanced cultures is more of a premium placed on non-ordinary states of mind.
But it wasn't for a long time before we actually looked at what shamans were doing, what indigenous cultures were doing, and honored the fact that, A, these were sacred states of mind, and, B, they were normal states of mind.
Right. And oftentimes those cultures place a larger stock on the value of dreams as well.
Yeah.
And it's only been the last 100 years that people actually in psychology in the West have put much merit in the investigation and the analysis of dreams.
And it's only recently that we've looked back at our heritage of the indigenous cultures and honored all that they had to bring to the table. And
well,
not look at them as primitive fast savages, and we are so full of progress here.
Well, yes, especially their familiarity and comfort with the spiritual realms, the non-material realms, which have kind of taken a hit in our culture, which is mostly focused on things that can be objectively measured and observed.
Right. And, you know, if they weren't Christian, they were of the devil. I mean, that attitude prevailed not so many decades ago.
Well, still does, I think.
I thought we'd gotten over that one.
Well, in Bellevue, so, maybe, but...
And that all that they did was mere superstition. Now we're understanding that, boy, they knew their way around, not only this world, but of the next.
Well, so. I think so. And I think part of what we discovered with our DMT research is... the amazing consistency and complexity of those non-material or spiritual realms, which actually, you know, could be generated or elicited or stimulated through the use of just a simple chemical, which our brain is producing all of the time.
And those chemicals then would be access roads, not that they're just creating an illusion, but they're actually the access roads to something that's existing.
Well, it
perhaps.
Just depends, yeah. I mean, there are people who would attribute all of those visions, images, sights, and sounds that are brought on by these agents as just figments of a disordered brain. But I think after a while you just start splitting hairs, though, because if there is DMT produced all of the time in our brains, it really does kind of make thin the distinction or the kind of barriers between a hallucination and everyday reality.
Good point. Good point.
I think it's a matter of degree at a certain point rather than of kind.
Yep. Just a quick aside, the LSD experiments that were going on, and we've heard from Stan Grof over the years and others who were participating in them, and even the Ibogaine more recently, that used in a therapeutic way, some amazing breakthroughs were made with people with long-standing emotional problems and trauma, and et cetera. And then the attitude, just don't do any drugs, I guess, prevails. Personally, I just want to explain, I've never done any drugs, but I've always had mystical experiences.
Well, you have, huh?
And I always felt, and I was told early on, don't take the chemical drugs because it will thwart your body's natural ability to do this. But then I, you know, used meditative practices and such that I think induce the body's natural build up of these and then experiences. I don't know. We can discuss that one later.
Mm-hmm.
So, I've never taken drugs recreationally, but I do think that when they were used in a therapeutic way and people were making breakthroughs, for heaven's sakes, why not? Why not continue? And what happened to that?
It's true. That kind of research was just kind of getting off the ground at the time that the drugs were all placed in a very restrictive legal category, and all of those studies basically dried up. But Stan Grof has probably described to you, there were some incredible cases of people that had gone through every possible means of helping with their psychological problems, panic attacks, depression, psychotic states, suicidal states, post-traumatic states, that had received shock therapy, had been in psychoanalytic therapy for years and years, and their progress was really jump-started or catalyzed through the prudent use of a psychedelic compound in the context of a therapeutic protocol.
They got their soul talking to them finally, or something. Something was happening.
Well, either they were able to remember things that they just couldn't access otherwise, or they were able to make an emotional connection to a memory or to a circumstance that they were just unable to otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And those studies were really getting to be promising. They were really getting off the ground. And the kind of fine-tuning that occurs as a research methodology is allowed to mature naturally, what is the best way of giving the drug, what doses, how frequently, what patient population, what were the techniques that were best that were best able to be used in combination with the drug. Those sort of questions weren't able to be asked, and certainly weren't able to be answered when these drugs were all placed into into the restrictive legal category that they ended up.
But fortunately, DMT can't be, because it's a component that our body produces naturally that's found in the plant kingdom naturally that we're ingesting anyway. So you really can't put that in that category. Is that the ticket for the research that you did?
It is a scheduled drug. Yeah. In terms of the scheduling of drugs, which all occurred with the passage of a congressional law in 1970, the most restrictive category is called Schedule One, and LSD is in there, heroin's in there, when all the drugs were placed into various categories, they also placed DMT into Schedule One. So it is a Schedule One drug. It's illegal. You know, obviously it's a strange kind of paradox, because all of us are making it. There's all these plants in our front yards and backyards that have DMT. But still, it is a Schedule One drug.
Well, I can understand the difference, too. I mean, I guess coca leaves you can chew very safely, but distill it, make heroin, inject that in, it's a very different reaction.
Well, it's a completely different experience, for sure. If people are chewing coca leaves, there's not much in terms of abuse or dependency problems, those sort of things, because... it's a small amount which is being released quite slowly over the space of a day, as opposed to smoking pure cocaine, which ends up with levels in the brain, 1,000 times what mm-hmm. would occur if you were just chewing the leaves or drinking a mild...
Yeah, that can't happen in the natural state. So so when you targeted DMT as the molecule that you wanted to experiment, and then you're applying for the grants and the studies, must have been a big hurdle then to start to deal with a Schedule One drug and all the permissions required, et cetera. What was that process like?
Oh, it was unbelievable. I really banged my head against a wall for a couple of years, really. It was the first time anybody had really made any effort in almost 20 years to actually do an above-board scientific study with a Schedule One drug. So, it took me 2 years of going through committees, paperwork, phone calls. It was like a Kafka novel in lots of ways. As it turned out, it wasn't as much the case that people weren't interested in being helpful. It was just more the case that the protocols were not in place to actually expedite a reasonable request to study a drug of abuse. And my application kind of pointed out a major weakness in the federal regulations that concern studies in humans. Is people are abusing drugs, but to be able to actually study the drugs and their effects and maybe develop cures or preventative sort of measures for problems that might occur with drug use.
And to understand our own brain and body chemistry.
Oh, absolutely. The effects of the psychedelics in particular are the most interesting of any of the psychopharmacological agents out there.
And when we come back with Rick Strassman, he'll tell us about, I bet you had no problem getting volunteers to sign up. He'll tell us about the actual studies that he did in his protocols and the results that he found. All this and more can be found in his book, DMT, The Spirit Molecule. I'm Laura Lee. Let's continue our conversation with Rick Strassman. He's the author of DMT, The Spirit Molecule, A Doctor's Revolutionary Research into the Biology of Near-Death and Mystical Experiences. The Radio Bookstore has this at 800-243-1438 or radiobookstore.com. And Rick, before we hear about the protocols and use of your DMT experiments, I just have to quickly ask you, since we're on the topic of heroin and coca leaves, when Dr. Balabanova found traces of nicotine in those Egyptian mummies, my first reaction was, well, of course they were chewing coca leaves because that's what they would do. They weren't distilling heroin. So to say traces of heroin found in the tissue and hair of mummies, I think is misleading. I think they were just bringing over boatloads, because I do believe in diffusionism, of coca leaves and chewing those for their mystical, experiments that they were doing.
They could have been, and they may have been smoking opium, they may have been smoking opium poppies as well. which, you know, contains morphine and heroin-like substances, too.
Oh, and are puppies found in the old world and the new world as well?
They're found in the old world primarily.
So maybe they wouldn't have had to import that. They could have used poppies for that.
Well, if it was a morphine or a kind of heroin-like substance, that would have come pretty easily from poppies. If it was cocaine, it would have come from coca leaves, which may have been imported from South America.
Right, but the chewing of coca leaves would have shown those traces in the hair, or would they have had to have figured out how to distill heroin from coca leaves and shoot them up, you know?
No, I think if you just were, you know, if you were drinking coca leaf tea, there'd be enough cocaine in there to be deposited in hair or nail or skin tissue, or even bone, probably.
Good. So you're the first person that really had the definitive answer to that question.
Well, sure.
Knowing the biochemistry. So thank you for that.
Yeah.
Now let's get back to your research with DMT. Tell us about once you got the permission. And who did the permission come from, the DEA?
Well, it took quite a while to find a manufacturer of the DMT that would meet the requirements of the government for purity and sterility. I finally ended up being able to use a colleague who made the DMT as a friend named David Nichols at Purdue University in Indiana. And he agreed to make me a clinical batch of DMT, which met all the requirements of the FDA for the cost of materials, which was an extraordinarily reasonable cost. It took a long time to find someone that would agree to make the DMT at a reasonable price. I found a lab within the government that would make the DMT, but the cost they quoted me for making it according to government regulations and doing all the paperwork would have been around $50,000. And as it was, the cost of Dr. Nichols making it was $300, so I certainly had $300.
It's like those hammers, those $700 hammer markups, isn't it?
It's like a $50,000 hammer, yeah.
What is it made of anyway? Where do you go to get the raw materials to compound this together?
Well, it isn't that complicated a chemical to make, but the problem is obtaining the precursors or the ingredients. The ingredients are carefully watched by the DEA, too. And so if you were interested in ordering the precursors or the ingredients to make DMT, you'd be getting a call from the DEA wondering what was going on. So actually, in terms of making the drug, it's just a handful of ingredients, but mm-hmm. It's quite hard to get one's hands on those ingredients.
Is it a liquid, a powder? What form does it eventually come in, and how did you...
The first amount of DMT which I received was in powder form. It was about 5 grams of powder, and we dissolved it up into sterile salt water. And we were interested in approximating the effect of the smoked drug. It's smoked on the street, and since my funding came from the National Institute on Drug Abuse, I was interested in seeing if injecting the drug in some form would approximate the effects of the smoked drug. If it's smoked on the street, it starts quite quickly, within a few heartbeats or so, and it peaks in about 5 or 10 minutes, and then it's over in about a half hour or so. And so our first volunteer, the first volunteer received an intramuscular injection of the drug. It was a drug which had been studied actually in the first wave of psychedelic research, and all of those previous studies, when they injected it, it was given as an intramuscular injection. And so I started off with our first volunteer giving it as an intramuscular injection. But it was a lot slower, given through a muscle as compared to the smoked effect. So actually we ended up switching to giving it through the vein, which is even a little quicker than the effects of the drug when it's smoked. It occurs the effects begin to manifest within maybe two or three heartbeats, and they peak within about between 90 seconds and 2 minutes, and then people start coming down at around 4 or 5 minutes, and they're completely normal within maybe 25 minutes or so.
Hmm. How did you design your protocol? Did you figure out what people were doing on the street and say, well, then I'll modify that? I mean, in terms of how much and...
Well, sure. Well, it was kind of a roundabout way of figuring out what kind of dose to give. We started off with the intramuscular injection of the quantities which people had given previously in the first wave of studies in the 50s and 60s. And then when it seemed like that was too slow an onset, then we started giving it through a vein, and we reduced the amount by a factor of two or so, and then just started increasing it from there. The first couple of volunteers, when we were giving it intravenously, the effects were strong, but not quite what I was looking for.
What were you looking for?
Well, I was interested in the effect that people were describing with the full dose of smoked DMT.
Mm-hmm. And what were some of those reports?
Well, they're pretty remarkable. And the immediacy of the onfect, there's an incredibly powerful, I guess the best way to describe it is to describe it as a rush. It's just this overwhelming feeling of energy building up in the body and in the mind, which actually can't be contained. And it's as if consciousness kind of bursts out of one's body, because the intensity of the rush is so great as to almost not be containable within the everyday, you know, kind of vessel of our lives, of our bodies.
Sounding transcendent already.
It's pretty transcendent, and as a result of the experience, just not being able to be contained within one's body, people quickly and almost uniformly experienced an out-of-body experience. There was a pretty profound and clear-cut separation of consciousness from the body. And so where did the consciousness go? Well, it went into this very colorful realm. It's extremely visual. It kind of starts off with a kaleidoscopic kind of display of colors. And for some people, the visual imagery sort of stopped at just a kaleidoscopic visual display. But those colors were the most intense and saturated and colorful that they had ever seen.
Sounds like it's also acting on those vision centers in the brain or something, too. Huh?
It quite does, yes. There are parts of the brain that seem responsible for visual phenomena, and obviously DMT is affecting those fairly profoundly. And also kind of accompanying the display of visual imagery are really powerful emotions. It was pretty, as the effect of the drug began, people were kind of anxious just because of the strength and the rapidity of the onset. But once people kind of got themselves settled into the effects, there were quite powerful feelings of euphoria, of ecstasy, of bliss, which kind of accompanied the visual imagery.
Did people ever have bad trips? Were there ever negative emotions and negative visuals?
Yes, for sure. I'd say probably close to half of the people found themselves in some tight corners at some point in their experience. But I only recruited experienced hallucinogen users because I figured it was going to be a stressful experience to be getting intravenous DMT. And I wanted experienced volunteers to be able to kind of...
Well, you knew their physiology could handle such an experience because they had been through it before, right?
I did pretty much, even though just a handful of people were experienced with smoking DMT. It wasn't that popular street drug at the time, and as a matter of fact, it still is not that popular. But only a small number of the people that were in the study were experienced users of DMT. The remainder had taken mushrooms and LSD over the years. But even with those people being as experienced as they were, they still did find themselves in some tight places with DMT. It's pretty intense, and for even those people with experience smoking it, the intravenous way of taking it was significantly more profound than their smoked responses in the past.
Were you able to at least get a sense of the kind of factors involved when people had a good trip as opposed to a bad trip? Was it their mood, their particular day, something that happened? You know, did you find any correlation?
Well, I think the most common cause of a bad trip was people not being able to let go. You know,
what so you're resisting the experience as it's happening?
They tried to slow it down. They tried to resist it. They tried to stop it even. But once the effects of the drug began, it's pretty relentless. And the people that had the worst experiences were those people that just couldn't relax into it. Mm-hmm. You know, I would kind of warn people to maybe think, well, I would prepare people to the possibility of thinking that the injection of the drug had killed them. Because for a number of people, the first perception that they would have was being out of body in some very, very strange realm.
They were having a near-death experience.
And they thought to themselves, well, maybe I'm dead, and this is what it is like to die. So I would kind of warn people of the possibility of them flashing on that as they kind of came to in that state. And I would tell them that there were two ways of going. Either to panic and say, what the hell is this, and get me out of here as fast as I can. Or else the other response is, well, I've died, and this is very interesting, so let's kind of see what happens next. Still, though, even with that kind of preparation, some people would panic when they found themselves in that state, not being quite certain about how they got there and how long they had been there and how long it was going to last for, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if people could relax, if they could be as relaxed as possible as the drug was going in, just take a deep breath and then an out breath, and then things were underway. In those cases, it was easiest for them to experience the more positive aspects, the bliss and the ecstasy.
And I'm sure that's why in various indigenous cultures you had quite a protocol, and you had guides and you had teachers with you, and it made it for a safer space than just taking a drug which you don't know the purity of it on the street. Yeah. Two very different experiences.
They're completely different experiences. And you know, our studies were all taking place in a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
With intravenous lines in place. I was drawing samples of blood while people were tripping. There was a blood pressure cuff going off every few minutes. But, all of those things were kind of horrific. But still, if somebody was really able to let go, which the majority of our volunteers were,
mm-hmm.
All of those extraneous external factors really kind of, weren't that important.
So when people came out of their experience, then you recorded what it was, and you were testing them as they were undergoing it and before and during and after. What kind of parameters were you looking for? What did you find?
Well, I was interested in the psychological effects primarily, but in terms of objective kinds of biological data, it's easier to write grants and publish papers if you have real objective hard biological data.
What'd the blood pressure do? during these
episodes? Well, it really went up. In fact, some folks had a kind of close calls with their blood pressure as far as really an increase in their values. One guy had a blood pressure response of over 200. His top number went over 200, bottom number went over to about 150.
You didn't want to lose anybody. So do you have nurses standing by to administer counteractive effects and all that?
Well, yeah, and we really screened people carefully before they got into the study to make certain their blood pressure was normal. Mm-hmm. But still, we had a couple of close calls with blood pressure. One guy's blood pressure actually became extremely low as a result of his DMT experience.
Why would that be, do you suppose? And did he have an unusual trip? Was it a factor?
I think it was a response to his trip. Mm-hmm. He found himself in outer space being steered toward a space station, and he ended up in the space station with all these androids around him.
Yeah.
And he was just startled. He was so shocked at the effect. His blood pressure just bottomed out. And he opened up his eyes, which was a mistake, and he looked around the room at me and the nurse and the hospital room, and his blood pressure went even lower.
When he opened his eyes, what did he see? Did he see you, or did he see an overlay of wherever he was?
Well, it was an overlay of what was happening in his trip and an overlay of all the visual kinds of things that occur when people are on psychedelic drugs, the distortion and the amplification, those kinds of things. And actually, a few volunteers early on in the studies opened up their eyes too early. And so as a result of their sort of unpleasant experiences, we started making certain that that people were kind of wearing blinders on their eyes. And if they opened up their eyes just in kind of a reflex manner to orient themselves, they would still be kind of a black space, and they would just close their eyes again and relax into it some more. But it would be a bit disorienting for people to open up.
Yeah. What else did you test in terms of physiology?
Well, I was interested in all kinds of levels of hormones in the blood, including growth hormone and endorphins.
What'd you find?
Well, the concentrations of endorphins went up sky high. And
that
as a matter of
makes
fact,
sense, doesn't it?
Well, it does. Either as a stress response, which endorphins can be, but also I think as a corollary of the ecstatic states that people were in as well.
If people weren't having a good experience, did those endorphins not kick in? Was that one of the factors, or were they
No, it really didn't correlate with the quality of the experience.
Okay.
It was more of a correlation with the intensity of the experience.
What about stress hormones, cortisol and all of that? What happened there?
Well, all the stress hormones went up. Levels of cortisol went up, levels of growth hormone went up, levels of prolactin went up.
What is prolactin?
Well, it's an interesting hormone. It comes from the pituitary gland as well, as is the case with growth hormone and with endorphins. It is responsible for the production of a mother's milk.
The lactin, the milk. Okay.
Right. It's involved in the production of milk when a mother nurses. Its function in humans. Its functions in men isn't quite as well worked out as it is in females, but it seems involved in affiliative behavior and affiliative emotions in men.
Bonding?
Of bonding stuff, yeah.
Okay.
In terms of the levels of growth hormone, the levels of that hormone went up quite high as well. It was very interesting. Of this whole battery of blood tests that we drew, the only hormone that didn't go up were levels of melatonin from the pineal gland.
Oh, and melatonin's associated with sleep. How interesting.
Well, it's associated with sleep, but it's also, it can be increased by stress. I had performed a study a few years before the DMT one, in which we were measuring levels of melatonin in marathon runners in order to see if stress could increase levels of melatonin, and it did. So I at least was expecting a stress-related increase in levels of melatonin, but I also was thinking if there was any relationship between DMT and the pineal gland, then perhaps big doses of DMT would stimulate the pineal to make melatonin, but I turned out to be wrong. So the pineal gland is incredibly well protected from any kind of stress phenomena, as indicated by the results of our study anyway.
Oh, how interesting. Huh. What else, what other insights about the pineal gland did you have?
Well, at least in terms of our study, the main pineal factor that we were looking at was just kind of the indirect reflection of its activity through the levels in the blood of melatonin.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed as if it didn't budge. So just in terms of sort of objective data to support my theory of a relationship between the DMT response and the pineal response, it came up empty, which was a humbling finding, as it were.
It's always paradoxical, I think, when you're getting close to something.
Well, I know. Of all the slews of hormones that I was studying, I'm the one I was really crossing my fingers about that would increase was going to be the levels of melatonin. It was the only one that didn't move at all. So, I kind of had to make me re-evaluate some of my thinking about the pineal.
Brainwaves, did you also monitor brainwave activity, alpha, theta, delta?
Well, yeah, in a couple of studies, well, in a couple of volunteers we did, but it was an intrusive study. If you hook people up to an electroencephalograph, which is the machine which measures brainwaves.
The EEG?
Yeah, the EEG. It requires the gluing of all of these foul-smelling electrodes onto somebody's forehead. And their scalp and all around their head. And it's a really strong-smelling glue. It's a really big machine, and it really intruded upon people's experiences. And I also performed a few brain scans on a few people, but it was the same sort of thing. The equipment was so loud and so intrusive and was so much a part of the experience that I didn't feel that...
Was that critical to alter the experiment to grab that data?
Yeah, I think it was really kind of cruel in a way to expose people to that level of technological intrusion during their vulnerable and kind of open state of mind, which results from these high doses of drugs. So,
did you get any results that were interesting in the few experiments that you grabbed that data?
No. We really just began those EEG and the brain scan studies, and they were pretty high-tech and required a huge amount of statistical analytic work on those those data. And, you know, the first few folks didn't really result in much as far as brainwave changes or brain scan changes.
So and this is not the avenue that you want to go?
No, it was kind of starting to treat people like large lab rats.
Okay.
And the experiences weren't going to be as important as the as the numerical data. And once that started happening, I wasn't that interested in those kinds of research studies.
And in rethinking the pineal, would you agree with the ancient assessment that this was just a key access point for mystical experiences?
Well, I still think it is. But, you know, in terms of real objective data supporting those theories, you know, we're still sort of at an early stage. We don't really have any definitive answers. But
do you have more experiments planned that have to do with the pineal gland? Are you going to go further in that direction?
Well, I kind of took a break from these studies around 7 years ago. I left New Mexico. I've just returned over the last couple of years or so, but yeah, I just have a straight psychiatry practice right now. I am sort of rethinking the idea of doing research, but I'm not currently involved with any, and I don't have any immediate plans.
By the way, I want to mention that we will do a second hour with Rick Strassman, part two, and in there we'll give him a chance to tell us about his own thinking that maybe alien abductions has to do with the accidental release of DMT in your body. You're not there in the lab taking it through an injection or smoking it on the street. What happens when someone has a near-death experience like so many that were cut of the same cloth, says some doctors who study this. It's a very common thing. What happens when someone has an episode in a dream of an alien abduction? What happens when you meet an angel? Could it be that your own body's releasing some DMT to help you access that? Or we'll find out what Rick Strassman has to say about that coming up. His book, again, is DMT, The Spirit Molecule, A Doctor's Revolutionary Research into the Biology of Near-Death and Mystical Experiences. I'm Laura Lee. Welcome to Conversation for Exploration. Hi, I'm your host, Laura Lee. You ever wonder about the timing of mystical moments that happen spontaneously? They happen, I think, when our soul wants to speak to us directly through that language of symbol and experience. And what about these spiritual techniques that have been practiced for millennia? And how do they habituate or make a habit of going through that doorway, if indeed both of these experiences, the spontaneous and the practiced, make use of a compound that is found in our bodies naturally, in fact, in the plant kingdom, as Rick Strassman has been telling us in the first hour of our conversation, and this is the second as we continue to talk about his work and his book, DMT, The Spirit Molecule, A Doctor's Revolutionary Research into the Biology of Near-Death and Mystical Experiences. Rick is back, and we continue to discuss what he found when he had volunteers take DMT and report some extraordinary experiences in a hallucinatory sense, going through a doorway, perhaps. And don't we do this naturally anyway with spontaneous mystical experiences? Welcome back, Rick.
Well, thanks, Laura.
You were reporting in the last first hour about the kind of, I don't know, altered state that people went to, out-of-body experiences that people were having
right
when injected with the DMT in your experiments. What happens when we have these experiences naturally? Let's start there. What do you think is happening, and did you look to people's anecdotal reports and correlate them as well?
Well, I was actually most interested in DMT because of its existence in all of our bodies, and I was quite keen on seeing if administering DMT to normal volunteers might replicate the reports of other people in the mystical literature, the near-death literature, even the schizophrenia literature, let's say.
And also alien abductions. You don't always have to see angels.
Well, no, but when I started the studies, I had no interest in the alien abduction phenomenon. In fact, I didn't know anything about it, and it was just as a result of the stories my volunteers were telling me that I was then kind of made to learn and start to listen to more about the alien abduction literature. But I went into the research expecting to hear stories the volunteers would be telling about states that I assumed would have a lot in common with reports from the near-death literature and the mystical literature, either the spontaneous mystical states that just descend upon people or those that result from a concerted effort with meditation practice or prayer.
And what did you find?
Well, I guess early on, I was kind of listening to and kind of heard the experiences that I was expecting to. I expected mystical experiences or mystical states to be elicited by a big dose of DMT. I was expecting near-death states to be pretty frequently represented in the kinds of reports volunteers were giving. But as I was going through my 1,000 pages of notes that I had taken through those 5 years of study in preparation for writing the book, I went over every page of notes I had taken. The thing that really jumped out at me was not the frequency of near-death or mystical states, but the frequency of these contact experiences that people reported of encounters with these non-material entities or beings, creatures, those sorts of things, which I had written down as they were describing them to me, but then I had forgotten about them. And it wasn't until just last year or so when I was preparing to write the book that the frequency and the uniformity of these experiences just kind of made themselves, so obvious that I just couldn't ignore them any longer.
Let's talk about the frequency and then the uniformity. How frequent were these?
I'd say they occurred in around one-half, maybe one-third to one-half of the volunteers. And we had around 60 people in the study. They got 400 doses of the drug over the space of a number of years and a number of research protocols. So, anywhere between maybe 35 and 45% of people had at least some fleeting contact with these intelligent, non-material kinds of entities.
They just sort of float by? Were they interacting, speaking with, observing? And the uniformity of these experiences, talk about that as well, if you would.
The kind of images people would report were kind of repeating. A number of people described these creatures as insect-like or reptilian. Mm-hmm. That was probably the most common. Alligators, mantises, bees, ants, but quite large and quite intelligent. A number of people reported that these entities or these beings were extremely interested in our emotional lives, our emotional reactions and states. It almost seemed as if their non-corporeal or non-physical kind of reality precluded them having emotional responses or an emotional life.
So we were oddities to them, huh?
I think we had something, or we have something that they want, that they may have once have experienced, but couldn't any longer. I have to kind of pause for a moment about these descriptions. I'm kind of talking about them in a matter-of-fact sort of way, but, it took me a few years of really thinking about these reports before I attained any sort of equanimity about even thinking about them, let alone talking about them to other people. Like I was describing, I wrote these notes down on my notebook when people were talking, but I then, as quickly as I wrote them down, forgot about them just because I was not expecting these reports. And even the volunteers weren't expecting these reports. These studies were taking place in the early 1990s when the whole alien experience really wasn't that much a part of the mainstream.
Good point.
And as time went on and people were reporting more and more of these experiences under DMT, I would ask them if they knew anything about UFOs or aliens or unidentified flying objects, those sort of things.
To see if they were bringing in their own imagery and interest into the experience?
Yeah, I was mm-hmm. curious about that. And the majority of people with those sort of experiences either were completely unfamiliar with any of the literature on aliens or had no interest or were quite skeptical about the whole phenomenon. It wasn't as if these were a large group of alien aficionados who came into the study with a set of expectations and beliefs about what they were going to experience.
Right.
These alien contact or contact with these beings, those sort of experiences were really unexpected. And as a matter of fact, a number of volunteers were really kind of embarrassed to start speaking about them. Mm-hmm. I would sit quietly and encourage them to talk, and they would kind of preface their remarks by saying, well, I just don't know if I want to tell you what just happened, because it's just too weird. And I say, well, you know, that's fine, go ahead. And they would talk about being probed and being tested and being studied and ending up in a spaceship with incredibly busy android humanoid kinds of workers kind of bustling around and taking samples and intervening and programming their brains and kind of testing things. So they were quite embarrassed and were kind of sheepish about even describing them to us.
And isn't it interesting that that's right about the time that you heard all these stories of people having these experiences just on their own? What do you make of this? How do you explain this?
Well, in terms of learning about, terms of the larger literature, I kind of had to. I really had no interest in the phenomena, but then as more and more of the volunteers started reporting them, then I had to, you know, I was
investigate.
Obligated.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was obligated to start to learn more about the spontaneous alien encounter phenomena. And I was really impressed with the amazing similarities between the reports of all our volunteers and those of people who report spontaneous abduction experiences.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of feeling of speeding up, the feeling of a rush, the feeling of really overwhelming pressure building up in the head until it almost explodes into the panorama or the phenomena under discussion. The incredibly powerful emotional reactions to the phenomena, the fear, the anxiety, the ecstasy, those sort of things. So it seemed more and more at least plausible that some of the spontaneous abduction experiences may have been related to perhaps the release of DMT in these people, which kind of mimicked what was happening in our laboratory setting of large amount being given to the volunteers. It's very strange.
Very strange. Would it necessitate a huge release, and does the body do that naturally or accidentally or only in the dream state? But these people were having like a lucid dream or a waking state, or, you know, what, some little spaceships coming by and sprinkling them with this substance so they can go in and around? I mean, you know, you can imagine a lot of different scenarios.
You can imagine a lot of different scenarios. I don't think the one about the spaceship sprinkling the DMT on people is that plausible, but, I mean, who knows? It could be. In the spring of last year, I was interviewed by Whitley Strieber, and we really kind of batted around the whole thing of the similarity and what kind of differences occur between the reports of all our volunteers and both Strieber's experience and those of a lot of the people that he's spoken with. And we kind of were thinking of a spectrum of encounters with these beings. At one end of the spectrum is the purely consciousness-to-consciousness encounter,
mm-hmm.
Which just occurs kind of mind-to-mind or consciousness-to-consciousness. And at the other end of the spectrum is the purely physical encounter with, you know, objects and burn marks and that sort of stuff. But what probably occurs, if it is a real phenomenon, which, you know, one could argue about forever, but if it is a real phenomena, then probably the vast majority of the encounters occur at some point between those two extremes of the poles of pure consciousness to consciousness or physicality to physicality. You know, I think what occurred in our study was probably just what I would think of as the the kind of pull of pure consciousness to consciousness encounter. You know, clearly there was no physical evidence of, you know, being manipulated. There was certainly, all this stuff was just occurring in our hospital room. So, you know, there was a complete, absolute kind of lack of any physical evidence. But
were the same people having the alien encounters, or did it have a smattering across the whole group, or?
Well, I'm not sure what your question is.
I guess, were the people who saw the aliens in their DMT episodes, were they the same ones consistently, or did the whole group? Well, you said about half. I'm sorry, half of them.
Yeah, it was okay. Around half the group, probably. You know, it was curious. There was one study in which I gave DMT a number of times one morning.
Yeah.
A large dose, then a half hour went by, then another large dose, then another half hour. In the space of a few hours, people got four injections of DMT. And with a number of those volunteers, the development of the experiences kind of followed a course of closer and closer and more intimate contact with these beings. The stories got more elaborate. The level of interaction and communication became a lot more profound. So from experience to experience, at least within the course of a morning, the same person would just kind of would kind of carry on from one trip to the next in terms of the
depth and the unfolding of what happened.
The progression and evolution of a relationship.
Boy, interesting. So they just kept coming back, you would think, to the same place.
Yeah, and it would be a continuation that would kind of build upon the previous experience.
Did you follow up with the volunteers to see if they had UFO experiences or sightings or encounters on their own afterwards? You know, once introduced, do they keep coming back?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. No. Well, you know, in terms of your question about, you know, about following up, yeah, I have followed up with a number of the volunteers, but no, in terms of whether or not that kind of opened the door for more frequent contact or spontaneous contact.
I have a favorite UFO researcher who says that after he was investigating this phenomenon by following up on reports that would come in, he headed the MUFON for the country of Canada for a while. He said suddenly one day, the phenomenon went after him, and all sort of weird things started happening, and, you know, he just had to say, stop, and it stopped.
Uh-huh.
So it was very interesting. Have you had any such experience where odd things started happening to you outside the context of the experiments?
Well, it was a pretty hard time for me. It was pretty stressful. I was giving a lot of people a lot of DMT. And I was hearing a lot of really unusual stories. People were going through some amazingly positive and kind of negative states.
Mm-hmm.
So I was going to a very intuitive body worker at the time, sort of at the tail end of the research. And she kind of stopped and said to me, I'm worried about you. There seem to be these beings that are trying to become corporeal through you and through the research. And I think that it's a bad thing and you ought to stop. So
that would freak me out, yeah.
It was a pretty funny report from her. I kind of laughed and said, oh, don't worry. But, you know.
Did you feel like you were opening a door through the rift of consciousness? And
well, I felt like in a way I'd opened Pandora's box.
Yeah.
I had opened this kind of portal for all these people to encounter all of these experiences. And I must admit, I was expecting a lot of mystical states and a lot of psychological kind of healing, as it were, through these studies. But I think we gave too big a dose of DMT. I think we just blew people right off course. And they ended up in these really unexpected, unusual realms. And I wasn't expecting them. I wasn't expecting these contact stories. And I was having a hard time explaining them to the volunteers and to explaining them to myself. Like, what am I doing and what is going on here? It's kind of like, who's in charge of this work anyway?
Did you lower the dose over time?
Well, we didn't lower the dose, but the studies became a little more complicated. They became a lot more pharmacologically oriented and not quite as psychologically oriented. So I was trying to modify the effects of DMT with other drugs, like to block its effects or to modify its effects. So the doses ended up not being quite as high as a result of the combination.
Of the blocking ingredients? What do you find that blocks, I mean, besides Thorazine? Are there substances that people are ingesting on a regular basis that would tend to counteract the natural ingestion of the DMT to be counteractive to it?
Well, in our studies, I was pre-treating people just a few hours before the injection of DMT. To determine if we could block the effects, or I guess even more accurately is, you know, to blunt the effects. And we briefly studied a narcotic blocking drug. It's called naltrexone. it made people pretty uncomfortable just all by itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it was hard to get the volunteers to get into that study. We also were treating people with a specific antihistamine, which also is a blockader of serotonin. And the volunteers really got sleepy and dopey on that drug. It was hard, you know, to get those people, you know, to take that drug as well. You know, so we were kind of starting those studies, but they were hard to tease apart what were the effects of the medication alone versus what were its effects on blocking DMT. Also, it was hard to recruit volunteers for those studies. Nobody was that keen on getting in a DMT study that kind of reduced the effects. So it was around that time that the studies became not quite as much fun to do. People were not quite as enthusiastic about volunteering.
Mm-hmm.
Adverse effects started to just seem a little clearer to me, and also I wasn't really getting that impressed with any long-term benefit from people's big experiences on DMT. So there were a number of factors that kind of got me to start slowing down the research and ultimately stop doing it around the end of 1995 or so.
They, so many spiritual traditions say that one's intent going into a meditation, a prayer, a ceremony, whatever, is the key. And I have found, too, that say a prayer before you meditate, and I have a much better meditation, a much more mystical one. Did anybody add some of those elements? Here, I intend to, you know, commune with our Creator as opposed to an alien.
Oh, yes.
Are people able to direct the nature of their experience at all through their intent or
requests? Well, for the first few minutes, it was really quite impossible to direct anything. All one could do was hold on. But a lot of people kind of went into it, either chanting or praying or meditating.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they started coming out of it, they would then continue with the chanting or hand movements, breathing, that sort of stuff. But everybody went into it with an intent to become a healthier person, to encounter a source of love and of wisdom and of healing. But like we were talking about in the first half of the interview, the most important thing wasn't even as much intent as really being able to relax into the onset of effects. If anybody had any resistance or any fear, really tried to hold on or resist, they really had a hard time.
But you end up on an operating table with aliens and androids standing over you. That could be a little intimidating.
It really blew people's minds. It really blew mine, too. I mean, I would hear these stories. I'd say, oh, shit, what's that? You know, so, yeah. So I took notes and said, well, I've been hearing more and more stories like that, but I just kind of, you know, tucked them away for future reference. It was hard to come up with an explanatory model, either to me or the volunteers. Like I would say, oh, it's your brain on drugs. And they'd say, well, no, it didn't feel that way. There couldn't be a center in the brain that mediates alien contact. And I say, yeah, probably not.
Well, two questions on that. One is, how real was it to the person experiencing it? Was it like, you know, viewing something distorted, or was it very physically real to them? Was
it
like a dream?
Absolutely real, undeniably real. a lot more than dreams, a lot more than everyday reality. They would say that was more of a real experience than everyday reality.
Oh, one of those.
It was so absolutely compelling.
Wow.
Yeah.
The other question is, wasn't there some open brain studies in which somebody took some instrument and stimulated parts of the brain, and there was one little part where consistently a number of people had encounters with like little blue alien beings or something? I read that somewhere.
Yeah, well, I think you may be talking about
Persinger's.
A fellow up in Canada.
Persinger, yeah.
His name is Persinger.
Persinger, okay.
And he's got a helmet that he puts on people, which kind of stimulates brain. Well,
he wasn't doing open brain. That was another study. But
no,
he had something similar that would stimulate a certain section, was finding that kind of response. So, go ahead.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure. I'm trying to think. Because there clearly are studies where people are undergoing open brain surgery, and they do have little bits of their brain stimulated for experimental purposes.
As I've read it both places, I think. So.
Yeah, but in terms of more contemporary research that I'm familiar with, this Persinger fellow in Canada is doing work where he places a special kind of helmet on people, and it can induce a feeling of there being someone else in the room or of a contact experience, but anywhere close to the kind of detail and intensity of reality that our volunteers described, those studies aren't anywhere close to the kinds of reports that we found.
When people went back consistently and interacted with these aliens, the stories that came up, were they similar in terms of the intent of the aliens? Why were they doing this? What was their quest, their lack of emotions? It seems all similar to the abduction literature out there.
Well, it kind of does, doesn't it? A couple of people reported that these beings were interested in our future and were kind of describing or were kind of portraying our future to us. Also, there was sort of some kind of reciprocity between us and them in terms of their intelligence and advanced technology in exchange for the emotional information that we possessed. So that also kind of dovetails with some of the spontaneous reports of abductees.
Hmm.
Some people were reporting being kind of tested. Certain parts of their bodies were being tested. Others described an experience of being reprogrammed or things being kind of implanted in consciousness that might manifest later on, or kind of a speeding up of psychological evolution, as it were.
You really need to do those follow-up studies with these volunteers, don't you, Rick? Just to keep a watch on them.
I do. Well, I've only been back in New Mexico about 18 months. I'm just getting my feet on the ground. So, and most of the volunteers still are living in the state, so it wouldn't be that hard to track down most all of them.
Yeah. So we will continue our conversation with Rick Strassman. And when we continue, Rick, let's hear about the other kinds of beings that were encountered. After all, shamans and indigenous people have walked through these doorways into the alternate reality for many, many millennia. And I'm sure it's populated by much more than aliens and angels. So any of those? And also, Robert Monroe, when he was doing his out-of-body research, felt that there were different shells around our Earth or our center here in the universe. And if you had changed the dose, do you think you would have ended up in different astral levels or whatever to correlate that? So all of that and more with Rick Strassman coming up. I'm Laura Lee. We continue our conversation with Dr. Rick Strassman, his book, The DMT, DMT, The Spirit Molecule. Rick, before you answer those two questions posed to you right before that break, I want to broaden the scope of it and ask, it would seem to me that the biochemicals are just one avenue or one marker of physiological change. Perhaps we're also changed by energetics or consciousness, prayer, intent, body postures in the work of Felicitas Goodman, I'm sure you're aware of, and sound therapy and color and fragrance and all of these things could then tend to stimulate the production of our own biochemicals in a certain way.
Right.
Also, you know, nature doesn't work alone in isolates, and I would think that the body would produce a whole gamut like you would find in the natural plant out there. There's a lot of,
synergistic.
Thank you. Synergistic compounds that go along with it.
Right.
So I would think that the body also, as nature would produce a whole gamut of these kind of chemicals, and that the DMT would be one element of a whole stew.
Well, that's true. Yeah, that probably is the case, and a number of other consciousness-altering compounds are produced in the brain. There's actually a chemical cousin of DMT, which is called 5-methoxy-DMT, which is quite hallucinogenic, and that's also made in the brain and the blood and the lung and the liver. And probably in the pineal gland as well, especially if DMT is. And there's bufotenine, which is in certain kinds of toads, and is also in plants, and also is produced in humans. So there is a stew, probably, of substances that the brain makes in order, you know, to help us make these transitions.
And so the type of experience one would have would maybe be mediated by the combination of these chemicals as much as anything. Maybe the DMT alone tended towards the alien experience.
It could, and the more kind of visionary one, right? You know, in the people I've talked with that have used this chemical cousin of DMT, this 5-methoxy-DMT. It isn't quite as visual. Mm-hmm. Seems to more produce experiences of the white light. It's more of a kind of death-like experience for a lot of people. So it may play a large part in those sort of experiences, to a larger extent than might be the case in the more kind of visionary ones that may be mediated through primarily DMT.
Also, a shaman would come and say, well, you know, it really also has to do with the spirit of the plant. And so if you have a chemical that is synthesized, it would still be very similar to a chemical found in a plant. And the plant spirit might have the aegis over that use of that, whether it came from a plant or not. It would still be the molecule that would be recognized. Or, you know, you might say something like that in terms of the devas that govern certain activities. I know that in looking at the literature of the ayahuasca use, and I even had a wonderful experience when someone just played the song that the ayahuasca shamans use.
They're quite the songs, aren't they?
Oh, just the songs alone gave me the experience. I didn't need the plant.
Right.
So, you know, that would be explained by, well, the spirit of the plant or the spirit of the shaman is carried along by those energetic waves.
I think so.
So, you know, it's just a very whole interesting realm here with many different elements to it. And it's fascinating to look at one element, but then also to contemplate what it would look like with all of these other elements added, and which is what the spiritual practices are, and what happens when someone practices a certain meditation or a certain chanting or whatever. Could that be stimulating DMT and similar molecules in our own body, which is why we have those mystical experiences associated with those practices?
Well, I think so, sure. Any experience in the mind, obviously, has got a correlate in the brain. It might not be cause and effect. We could really spend a lot of time about the cause versus the effect sort of discussion, but
it's
still
a rather chicken and egg question.
The chicken and egg, but I think it's unarguable that there are at least correlates of conscious experience in the brain, and if the changes in the brain occur first, and the consciousness then kind of follows thereafter, or if the effect on consciousness then kind of results in the release of these chemicals in sort of a cascading form is a hard question to answer. But there are clearly correlates and probably some kind of biological underpinning, as it were. I don't know if I would actually call it causal, but at least an underpinning.
Well, when you looked at the when scientists have looked at the near-death experience, and then they see, well, if you stimulate the right front lobe of the brain, you get going down the tunnel and seeing the bright light, and therefore it's just an hallucination.
Uh-huh.
You could also counter and say, well, that's just the cascade sequence that's already programmed into our brain to allow access, and when you stimulate that through an episode in which you almost died, or profound dreams, which can also you can also have of that nature, or external stimulus, such as in the lab, then this is what's happening. It's also interesting that shamans report having to die before they find their powers or their way back. You know, they have similar kinds of episodes. Who knows that it doesn't gear the body up for future experiences. I don't know how all that works, but it's certainly intriguing. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the whole issue of reproducing some of these experiences in a laboratory-controlled environment is a really intriguing one. My book, I do describe in fair detail a scenario in which DMT is released at the time of death, and it would help kind of mediate the movement of consciousness out of the body as it's dying. And if that were true, and, you know, a number of our volunteers reported near-death experiences, and almost everybody reported a sense of their consciousness leaving the body, and if there were big amounts of DMT released at death, it opens up the possibility of a dry run, of being able to practice the process of dying. If it's the same physiological sort of basis, if there's a lot of DMT around at the time of death, and if you could give a lot of DMT, to kind of mimic what they're going to be expecting later on when they are in the dying process, then, it might provide some practice. It might allow people to negotiate or learn to negotiate those spaces with some familiarity, so when the time of death occurs, and if there is a lot of DMT released or similar compounds, then people will not be so surprised. They'll say, oh, right, this is familiar, and I will expect this and I'll expect that, and the best way is to let go into the experience and to open to it as best as possible, those sort of things.
And to really demonstrate that the soul continues after death. There is another realm to go to, that this physical world isn't all that there is. Or at least add to that argument.
Well, it certainly seems as if there's a non-material inhabitant or a non-material kind of habitation of consciousness, which isn't dependent on the body. And if it's, the whole thing of what is life and what is death, the means by which I started to model or explain some of these out-of-body sort of non-material experiences was to start to think about some of the recent developments in cosmology around the condition of matter, which is called dark matter. There's apparently 98% of the mass of the universe is invisible, which means it either doesn't reflect light or generate light. That's 98% of the mass of the universe. And it's streaming through us at all times. It keeps our visible universe from flying apart. It kind of permeates and surrounds this universe. So it seems to me if there is the vast amount of mass of the universe invisible, it would seem that with just that the pure numerical fact of its presence would imply that it has to be inhabited. There has to be intelligences within all of that invisible matter. So it might be that one of the things that happens with DMT and some of these other compounds is that it changes the receiving characteristics of the of consciousness and of the brain.
And expands our bandwidth.
It expands our bandwidth. We are able to perceive channels that we aren't normally able to perceive. And there certainly are a lot of other channels out there. If 90% of what's out there we aren't able to see in our normal state of consciousness.
So it really puts mysticism back on the map, doesn't it?
It sort of does. And it also, our studies kind of demonstrate a reliable way of, you know, transporting people there or kind of changing their capacity to receive certain bandwidths.
What's the future of this work? Can you imagine or devise a non-invasive way of testing when someone is expanded the bandwidth? They could sit in your lab and do whatever spiritual practice, and you could, you know, see how far out they were going or in what direction. Can we, you know, have vehicles where we can go here or go there in consciousness rather than just leaving it up to a, you know, roll of the dice?
Well, you know, those studies wouldn't be hard. I mean, it's pretty grueling work, let me tell you that. But the kind of research that I could envision doing, I kind of spell out in one of the last chapters of the book what I would perceive as an ideal agenda and location for future research to take place.
What would that be?
Well, it wouldn't be in a hospital, and it wouldn't be purely biologically based, sort of treating people as large lab rats like I referred to earlier on. It would be to explore and help people with purely human functions and capabilities. So there would certainly be a lot of interest in some of the therapeutic work that you had alluded to that took place earlier on in the first wave of human psychedelic research. But I think it wouldn't purely be focused on psychopathology and making sick people better, but I think it would also be kind of geared towards the enhancement and expansion of normality as well. And I could think of a couple of areas where it wouldn't be a big stretch to conceive of just expanding current research thinking, which would involve studies into creativity, which is a very it's a very kind of hot topic in psychological research these days.
And the flow states, yeah.
Flow states, and also in terms of spirituality research, there's a increasing amount of interest in this field, which is called neurotheology, kind of the understanding of the biological bases of spiritual experience.
And the God spot that we have in our brain,
we're
hardwired for that as well.
Well, sure. And the book that came out not long ago, Why God Won't Go Away, which kind of talks a lot about how the brain mediates spiritual experiences.
And Newberg, we had him on too.
You did? Oh, great.
Yeah.
You know, so I think the spiritual, I think it is possible to do research in spirituality. You know, it's an interesting issue, though, in terms of turf and territoriality and ownership of fields. Well, I think whenever you start to mix science and religion, people within both of those areas start to feel as if their toes are being a bit stepped on. Within the organized religious contingent, there's concern that it's gratuitous or it's fake or it's dangerous. Within the scientific community, there's fear of becoming, you know, kind of mush thinking, just not thinking that clearly about objective scientific phenomenon. So
I personally think that you should go to the commercial realm And you could find substances, since they're in a lot of plants, what the precursors of DMT, and then package up a little pill that people could take, so you have a very mild increase of DMT, so that you can remember your dreams, so that when you're falling asleep or you're in those sort of waking states, that hypnagogic moment between waking and sleeping, maybe you could then maybe kick in, so you would have lucid dreaming, because what is that but the visionary state of dreaming with your conscious mind simultaneously functioning. So maybe you could find, I think the commercial realm would really find some interesting applications and lucrative ones as well.
Well, I think so, but you know, if the state of mind those pills induced was were too extreme, then obviously they would, you know, start coming under the scrutiny.
Right,
but you would want regulatory boards.
Just a kick, you know, just a little natural. And something the you know, nature knows how to deliver these doses, I think, either through your spiritual practice or your natural production thereof. So just enhance it a little bit, I guess.
I think so. And, you know,
because the body knows how to do this anyway. The body's producing this anyway.
Well, true. So. And if we either could slow down the breakdown of DMT by perhaps inhibiting some of the enzymes that normally would metabolize DMT and other related compounds, yeah, indirectly it would increase the levels and function of what's already there, for sure.
Or have institutes where people check in for a couple of weeks a year and just do deep soul work so that you live your life better the rest of the year, more productively, more happily, more balanced. I don't know. You could find some interesting.
Well, yeah,
we could dream an interesting future here.
Well, I know. I've been thinking of this concept of a spiritual clinic, or a kind of scientific monastery, as it were.
Oh, I like that.
Where there would be some kind of merging of both technologies and of ethics and of technique, of wisdom. You know, to just be able to expand the range of options that people have got available to them, to be able to choose where they want to go within the realm of their own practice, a scientific one, a creative one, a spiritual one, or an artistic one.
And what happens when we expand our inner vision? Then you are more creative, and then you see deeper into the world and yourself and your place in it. And the world would be a better place if we all could expand our inner vision.
Well, I think, but you know, there's clearly a number of logistical issues that would have to be addressed, especially if scheduled substances were being.
Actually, I don't believe in the chemical route anyway. I don't trust chemistry. I don't even take aspirin. I really believe that the body knows how to do this, and that you just set yourself in the parameters in which you have the body's optimal production of this. I mean, it's the best pharmacist that we have. It's the safest pharmacist that we have. So rather than inject a substance from outside, just do what, you know, rather than inject endorphins, we go for a run, right? Or we go look at a sunset. We know how to get the body to do this naturally, which is why I think that we've had this long story of spiritual techniques.
Well, I think. But it's also, you know, everybody isn't capable of maybe producing their own levels, or they've been in a cave and they've been meditating for 20 years and they just quite haven't broken through. I mean, wouldn't it be
a good jumpstart pill?
A good jumpstart for people that might just be biologically incapable of making that next step, if that were something that could be used by them.
Isn't that how drugs were used in the 60s for most people? You hear their war stories. Well, it really broke me through, and then I didn't need drugs after that. Maybe it's a one-time episode.
Well, sure. It could be a one- or two-time experience within the context of some kind of discipline, which wouldn't obviously rely or make one dependent on the chemicals. But, you know, it's an interesting question. If somebody sort of struggles along without a breakthrough experience, are they any worse off than somebody with that breakthrough experience that never struggled and was never really able to integrate it into a useful application into their everyday sort of life.
But there's many different spiritual techniques, so if one isn't working for you, I would assume people would move on. I mean, we're practical in nature. We don't keep doing something that doesn't give any payoff. But you can also imagine another darker scenario. Once we find out how the brain works and its biochemistries and what the effects are, you could imagine this being harnessed for, you know, controlling people and all sorts of things. So it's kind of a dangerous road to open, I think, in some respects.
Well, it is a dangerous road to open. Yeah, the whole issue of brainwashing and the increased
manipulation.
Well, and it's been tried. There were a number of years of our government, you know, kind of giving people drugs without them knowing about it to determine if they would be helpful in interrogation or chemical warfare scenarios. You know, so that's been tried. And, you know, it's, you know, in a way, it's kind of like it's kind of like nuclear energy. It's been discovered. It's out there. So the main question is,
are we going to use it wisely?
What's going to happen with it? Yeah. Are we going to abuse it? Are we going to use it? Or are we going to lock it up and throw away the key? I mean, what are we going to do?
So what do you see for the immediate future? Is anyone else looking into these or related substances? Or are they contacting you and say, gosh, you had such a successful run, I'm thinking of... Or do you hear from... What's the response from the scientific community looking into these matters?
It's been pretty muted. It's been pretty low-key. Yeah, and even as I was doing the studies, my scientific colleagues were kind of amused about, oh, those drugs. It's been years since we've looked at those. You know, so people weren't that enthusiastic. I think among the older generation of researchers, they were bemused. Within the younger generation of researchers, they were pretty unfamiliar with the first wave of human research. They were curious, but they weren't that curious just because of the high risk involved in giving the drugs and the amount of work that went into actually getting the protocols approved and funded. So on both counts, people weren't really that eager to jump on board or to join me in Albuquerque to pursue this work. I've gotten a lot more feedback from, from the lay community. And, I would estimate that close to half of the correspondence I've gotten after my book came out have been stories from people that have told me of spontaneous experiences which replicate a lot of the reports of our volunteers, which kind of supports my thinking about that spontaneous release of DMT is behind a lot of these naturally occurring visions, mystical states, near-death states.
Do you think the body or the brain or the soul or the mind or the whatever engineers this, because it seems that mystical experiences happen at very meaningful times in our life when we come to the end of a road or we're asking for help or something? I mean, true, they just sort of come and hit you out of the blue too, but it's almost as though the soul can engineer this. I want to speak to you directly. Here, come for a visit, in a sense. Do you ever get that?
Well, if you think of a near-death or mystical state as kind of an ultimate stress response, because oftentimes these experiences occur during unbelievable, unbearable stress.
Exactly.
I
see, so the very stress would trigger the experience.
I think that, I've kind of spelled out a sort of a physiological way of looking at stress causing the release of DMT, either from the pineal or from other organs in the body. And the studies that have occurred in lower animals, like rats and mice and stuff, it clearly is the case that levels of DMT increase with stress. If you really stress an animal, then levels of DMT go up. And if you're really in a pickle psychologically or spiritually, if you are sleep-deprived for days and days, if you're doing a lot of meditation, a lot of chanting, any number of possible scenarios could ultimately end up with sort of the common denominator of a large release of DMT mediated through this confluence of stress-related hormones and biochemicals.
So the body knows how to do it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's clearly the case that the body knows how to do it. It's just kind of us understanding how the body does it. And also, I think once we understand what's happening in the body, then the questions are, well, what are we supposed to be doing with that information? And, you know, we are kind of a freewheeling society. Especially within the realm of Western science. If we can do it, then we do. So once we figure out what's happening with the body, and if, for example, we can prove that there are certain chemicals released at certain focal moments in our lives, then what do we do with that information?
Hard to put all the Pandora's box back together, isn't it?
Well, it is Pandora's box, and it's been opened. You know, I didn't open it. I guess I kind of did, you know, for this generation, but it's been open for a long time. You know, and it isn't purely the case that these indigenous cultures have got it together when it comes to these materials. You know, I've heard endless stories of shaman sort of being involved in spiritual warfare, and they're trying to kill each other under the influence of ayahuasca. All sorts of horrible things, you know. So these people's personalities aren't any more well-developed or able to use these substances, only as a result of them kind of living in the jungle, as it were.
That's a really good point you make.
And they still exploit their neuroses under the influence as much as we do.
Or their neuroses exploit the situation.
Well, true.
I guess. Well, thank you so much, Rick, for all of your research and the insights that you have lent to the whole quest of consciousness and altered states of consciousness. What is normal? What is possible? What is optimal? How do we widen the bandwidth? And thank you for your book, DMT, The Spirit Molecule.
Well, thanks very much for having me on the show.
And thank you for joining us today. Much appreciated. That was Rick Strassman. And thanks for listening. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online. www.lauralee.com